Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm David Brent Johnson, and our guest today is Indiana University Professor of Music Glenn Gass. Professor Gass teaches a number of courses at Indiana University School of Music, including classes on the Beatles and perhaps most famously the history of rock and roll. He is the author of numerous articles and also of many classical compositions, having received a doctorate degree in composition from Indiana University in 1985. In 2003, he was the recipient of the IU Student Foundation's Herman B. Wells Lifetime Achievement Award. Professor Gass, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Why did you pick that Neil Young track to open our program tonight?
It's not a typical Neil Young track. Obviously, there's no singing on it. But to me, it just seems to capture this sort of wistful America that when I was 14 years old, it functioned like almost like a movie, like a soundtrack to a movie in my mind, you know, and the strings are great. You know, I love that kind of string writing. I love that sort of a mixture, happy mixture of acoustic, electric, violins, you know, everything all rolled in together with the greatest song title ever, The Emperor of Wyoming. So to me, it just sums up something about America that I love.
Seems like it has an amalgamation of styles that you like. Well, that's interesting because you're commonly known as the rock and roll professor. I know that's what a lot of people like to call you. But I do want to go back to your childhood and where it all began, so to speak, to ask how your passion for music of all sorts started and not just rock and roll.
February 9th, 1964, like so many people roughly my age, I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, and that was it. I don't know why. I was fairly young. I was eight, but I became just a rabid Beatle fan. And I had the great fortune of growing up at a time when the Beatles were just an automatic fact of life. And the new Beatle record was a rite of passage every summer, every Christmas, the singles on the radio. And I traced that arc of, you know, just growing up with them as my big brothers. They just seemed to do the right thing at the right time. They kind of showed you it's okay here. It's a little weird, but it's okay. You know, every step of the way, they're like your really hip older brother that just looked so cool, did the right things, you know, sounded so great. And everybody sort of had that as a sort of a guiding star. It's impossible to overstate how important the Beatles were to that generation if you really grew up with them in your life. They were enormously important. I'm one of those people that measured his life by the length of John Lennon's hair, you know, almost literally. I was just obsessed with the Beatles, and my mother used to worry that there was a lot of wasted time going into listening to Beatle albums, but it worked out okay.
Well, yeah, now you're teaching about them at a university. What other – the Beatles, obviously, an overwhelming cultural touchstone for people growing up in the 1960s, but what other sort of interest in cultural touchstones did you have in that time?
Well, I mean, the Beatles were definitely my main focus, and then through – but they're like a center of gravity, the sun and the solar system around which the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, the Beach Boys, you know, all revolve. So – through, and just by listening to the radio, I remember listening to WLS every night in bed, and Simon and Garfunkel would be on, and then James Brown would be on after that, and the Beatles would be on after that, and Love and Spoonful after that, and Wilson Pickett after that. I mean, there just weren't any boundaries then, and then Green Tambourine or some stupid song you still can't get out of your head would come on after that, but it was such a wonderful connection. You know, the kind of the end, I think, of the glory days of AM radio when everybody sort of played everything and everybody listened to all different types of music and there weren't the sort of rigid playlists. And also, you know, you look at top 10 lists from almost any random week in the 60s, and what's astonishing to me is that it's great. The 8 out of the 10 songs are truly great. It doesn't happen that often that the best music being made is also the most popular. In fact, that rarely happens, but it happened then, so...
I know so many other people were inspired by groups like the Beatles to take up playing the electric guitar and things like that. Did it inspire you to take up any instruments, or had you already taken up any instruments? Or
I took up the badminton racket February 10th. Matt Foxon and Judy Cook and Jeannie White and I all got in the basement and pretended to be the Beatles and then argued about which one was in the middle. And, you know, it was like the classic, you know, you can't tell them apart with that hair. And then as soon as I became old enough, I had two goals in life. One was to grow my hair and the other was to play guitar. And I succeeded in the hair part better than the guitar, but I did start playing guitar a bit later. You know, by the time the Beatles broke up, then it was really Neil Young that kept me sane. That's why I enjoy starting a show with Neil Young, because he was my sort of entry into real the teenage years and the sort of emotional, you know, landscape I was entering then. And so that was great guitar music, of course, you know, Needle and the Damage Done or Old Man or any of those songs. So yeah, guitar and piano, but never very well. I'm a classic example of that Woody Allen line that those that can't do teach, or those that can't teach teach Jim, I guess is the extension of that. But.
Well, you've become well known for bringing rock and roll into the academy, but you actually spent your formative graduate student years immersed in the world of classical composition. You refer to this strong interest early on in rock and roll. So what took you down the path of classical composition?
Well, I actually went to prep school in Massachusetts, Andover, and I had a great friend named Lee Hyla, who's one of the best composers alive today, terrific, who was going to school in Boston, and I would spend every weekend with him. And I was desperately trying to figure out what to do with my life. And all I knew was that I really loved music. But I'd figured out by then that I wasn't going to be a Beatle. And that actually I probably
that
wasn't.
That job was already taken.
Yeah, it was taken. And I probably wasn't going to be Neil Young either. I had everything except the talent and the looks and the charisma, I think. I had. I didn't know what to do. And then I'd played violin as a kid and I'd listened to Beethoven and the classics. But I broke my arm four times, and that was sort of like, well, I give up. So I had sort of moved away from classical music. And
how did you break your arm four
that's
times?
That's a long story, starting at a summer camp and not being set right and then just falling on it, essentially. But I started hearing this music, which I'd never heard before, which is contemporary classical music. In fact, George Crumb, who was just here recently as guest composer in Bloomington, was one of my first big influences, a piece called 11 Echoes of Autumn. I'll never forget hearing that and just thinking, oh, my God, I can't believe music like this exists. And, in fact, I'd love to hear
Would you like to hear some of that right now? Okay, this is George Crumb.
George Crumb, 11 Echoes of Autumn, 1965.
That was an excerpt from George Crumb's 11 Echoes of Autumn, 1965. We're talking on Profiles with Professor Glenn Gass, who teaches at the Indiana University School of Music. Now, you said you went to school in Andover. Were you from the East Coast?
No. I'm from Greencastle, Indiana. I'm a Hoosier. No, both of my brothers had gone out to Andover. My oldest brother went there, and then my next brother went there with George Bush. I went there with Marvin Bush. So we're right there with the big guys. But it was while I was out there that it was sort of good for me to get away from Indiana and be exposed to, you know, a much bigger world. And that included the music. I mean, I don't know how I'd ever have heard that piece. The thing about that George Crumb piece, the 11 Echoes of Autumn, the sounds were so astonishing. And the landscape, the oral landscape and the emotional landscape, it just felt like a trip to Saturn. And you know, this is in the age of, you know, following Hendrix out into some weird feedback tangent and all these strange things going on in the rock world. So it wasn't that big a leap to go to just, it was far out, I guess, for lack of a better word. But I mean, in the best sense, it just opened my mind to, it's almost like a surreal painting that you can actually have this really vivid landscape depicted in sheer sound. And that was really exciting to me. And again, these are times when the lines aren't clear. I remember seeing a George Crumb concert at the Whitney Museum in New York, and there was a line around the block, and it looked like a Grateful Dead show. You know, I mean, there was young, there are older, you know, classical musicians, and then also young freaks to see George Crumb. And I remember one of them saying, I'm on acid and this is going to be so cool. And I said, whoa, okay, whatever. But it's like, you know, that would tend to happen now at Lincoln Center, you know, with a bunch of 20-year-olds. So it was a very different time. And people's – it was almost a duty for anybody interested in the arts to be open to all of them. And that was a terrific time to come of age as a musician. So to me, it wasn't a big leap to suddenly be into that.
How do you see that today? Because it's a curious thing, and these demarcations that get set about music, and we seem to go through periods where the period you're describing, they were sort of blurred, and you did this crossover. But then, you know, you go into music stores, and everything is kind of rigidly defined as, you know, the rock section is here, the classical section is there, the jazz section is there. And then – but then we go through periods again where it seems to become more eclectic. What do you feel accounts for that?
I think things need to get shaken up every so often, and they do, fortunately. Although I think that was a pretty unique time. I mean, I don't know where they put Cat and Beefheart in the record stores these days. Still don't know what to do with it. You know, there's somebody that I dearly love as well that obviously listened to Howlin' Wolf and Cecil Taylor and Ornette Coleman and you know, everything. You know, he and Zappa out in Lancaster, California in the desert absorbing everything they could. Those are the people that interest me most, I think, the people that have absorbed different traditions. I mean, that was what was so great about rock to begin with, that it absorbed blues and country and gospel and boogie-woogie and swing and created this great American hybrid. And I think that's what keeps our popular music vital in any era.
Where did you go after you went to Andover?
Well, I didn't like Andover, and I came back to Greencastle and was much happier and went to DePaul University in Greencastle, where I'm from, where my father taught, was head of the math department there for years. So I was a faculty brat growing up in small town Indiana, which was great. And then I transferred back out east to Boston to the New England Conservatory of Music. I didn't know until I got there that IU had a good school of music. This was sort of a secret in Indiana. I'm not sure what that meant, but I went out to Boston and people started asking me why I didn't go to IU, and I thought it was some strange joke they were playing on me.
Some kind of East Coast.
Yeah.
Tease the new Midwestern kid.
Right. And then I found out slowly that, we have a great music school down in Bloomington. They just didn't talk about it much in Greencastle. I don't know. It's funny. So I graduated from the New England Conservatory and taught for a year in Wisconsin, in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and then came here for graduate school and never left.
What was your experience like at the New England Conservatory of Music?
Yeah, it was great. It was an ideal time to be there as a composer. Gunther Schuller, great composer in his own right and conductor and jazz third stream person. I mean, yeah, he was the president of NEC when I was there. So the whole place revolved around new music. It was extraordinary. Yeah, there was guest composers coming all the time. All the performances were geared toward modern music. There was a person hired, their job as a student was to find performers for the composers and arrange rehearsals. It was ridiculous. It was just ideal. So it was a world in which new music, in contemporary classical music, really mattered. And it was really exciting. And again, the lines were very porous there. The jazz people interacted with the classical people all the time. And, of course, Boston was such a vibrant city. It was a terrific experience.
We played some music earlier from George Crumb. Who were some of the other classical composers who influenced you in the late 1970s and early 1980s when you were doing your work in classical composition?
Anton Webern was probably my biggest influence. He was a German composer, shot by an American soldier at the end of World War II, as a matter of fact. And he wrote these incredibly delicate, meticulous, tiny pieces. In fact, one of them, one of the pieces I particularly like is one called Six Bagatelles for String Quartet, which is very, very short. In fact, there's a movement that's about 45 seconds long, and it takes you on an amazing journey. It's always one of my favorite pieces of music. Thank you.
That was Anton Webern's Six Bagatelles for String Quartet, Movement Number 4. How is this you said this piece influences some of your own work, actually.
Yeah, it just he created a sound world that was really inspiring to me. It was so, you know, absolutely personal. It didn't really make reference to anything outside of itself. Like that music there, just, again, sort of like the George Crumb excerpts, it takes you out to Pluto in this wonderful way. To think of it being written, you know, almost 100 years ago is astonishing that someone would have that sort of vision. It's like Picasso saying, hell with this, we're going to do this and create this beautiful abstract language that makes perfect internal sense. And I, you know, for lack of a better expression, I loved that sort of trip it took you on. And I wanted to create music that had that similar sense of a delicateness often and sort of a journey.
How long did it usually take for you to develop and finish your classical compositions?
That 10 years, it seemed like forever. I was never a fast composer. And of course, these are the ink on onion skin days, you know, which people have been using since the monks 1,000 years ago. It's an extraordinary change that every composer, every young composer uses a computer now. And that's I remember hearing in school, someday people will use computers to write music. And I thought, yeah, right. Like my grandchildren might. It sounded like a science fiction thing, and it's happened so quickly. But I labored over it. You know, it was labor of love.
Well, let's hear one of your own compositions. What have you brought along for us to listen to?
Well, there's a movement from a string trio. It's a second movement called Almost Still. And I think after hearing the Webern, it's fairly obvious that it was deeply influenced by him.
This is Professor Glenn Gass's composition, Almost Still. Glenn Gass's composition, Almost Still. Glenn, when did you write that composition?
1983, actually, kind of in the midst of graduate school, for a terrific group called the Scott Chamber Players, who are still a terrific group in Indianapolis. And, you know, they play it so delicately, and it's called Almost Still, and it needs to be just barely visible. And, you know, it's almost like a meditation for me to compose a piece like that. It's a nice thing to get in touch with.
Who are some other composers that influenced you, classical composers?
Stravinsky, hearing The Rite of Spring for the first time, I mean really hearing it for the first time, was a mind-shattering experience for me. And Pierrot Lunaire by Arnold Schoenberg. I mean, those are the two every textbook says, the pillars of 20th century music, but it's true. It was enormously important for me. The Rite of Spring, I still think, is probably my favorite single piece. I can't believe it exists. Every time I hear it, I can't believe how good it is. It's such an extraordinary invention, again, from somebody in, you know, 1913 to reimagine music so thoroughly. And then, of course, all the attendant scandal and the riots at the premiere and, you know, the sense that music could matter on that level and inspire those kinds of emotions and the music of the future and the things that, you know, we associate with maybe rock and roll later, Bruce Springsteen.
It sounds like a prototype form of rock and roll.
Yeah, and it was. Actually, if we could hear a little of The Rite of Spring, that'd be great.
Here is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Thank you.
unbelievable. You know, I mean, it's like you're on a Paris street one minute and you're off somewhere else the next, and the rhythms are so, you know, strong and insistent. And again, so deeply strange for 1913. You know, I can imagine crowds howling. This is a ballet too, so you have this sort of visual component going on. But the colors are so extraordinary. It's vivid. It's like the literally the palette of colors has opened up. Suddenly you have new combinations of colors, literally, you know, of sound, of instruments. And, you know, it was a brave piece, a courageous piece. And that's...
That was the Games of Rival Tribes?
That's right. That's one of the little ballet sections from The Rite of Spring.
Kind of sounded like an early version of West Side Story to me or something. Yeah. I mean, that only in a very good way.
Well, yeah, because West Side Story was sort of like, well, is it popular, jazz, classical? You know, this was clearly a classical composer, but boy, Duke Ellington sure listened to him, and a lot of other people were very inspired. So
Charlie Parker, a lot of the bebop music, they worshipped Stravinsky. And in fact, as I'm sure you're well aware, he wrote a piece for the Woody Herman Big Band in the 1940s.
And he loved jazz. You know, it seems like in our Meode or these composers from somewhere else had to come here and go, hey, you got, you know, Dvorak did this. You guys are crazy. You're imitating Europeans and you've got all this great music, you know, the spirituals or whatever. Why aren't you, you know, pulling from your own tradition? America for a long time had the sense that we had to be sort of a watered down European culture to have any culture at all. And,
So I have to ask, knowing about your background in classical composition and such, do you write rock and roll tunes?
Well, I have. Yes, a good friend of mine, Van Bartley, and I basically grew up together playing songs and writing songs. And we did a piece. Yeah, there's a song called I Hope You're Happy as Me for the Live from Bloomington album in 1991. That was our biggest claim to fame. We got to play at the club night down at what used to be Jake's. And I told all my students to come and scream like I was Ringo, no matter how it sounded, and they did. It was outrageous. It was really like suddenly you're on stage and all these people screaming. It was really
fun.
It was
the Cavern in Liverpool,
right?
1962.
Right. Yeah. And it's just a sheer coincidence. I happen to have that.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Glenn Gass, and this is from 1991, and the name of the song, again, is...
I Hope You're as Happy as Me.
Say I'm not your problem anymore. You never gave your heart, you only loaned it. I never knew that's what hearts were for. But okay, be that way, it doesn't matter to me anymore. Alright, stay out all night, I won't be waiting by your door. I'll be up in the trees, craning to see the guy you left.
That was Glenn Gass, and I Hope You're as Happy as Me from the 1991 Live in Bloomington CD. So this was sort of your rock and roll moment in the sun, Glenn?
Well, and I should say it's Glenn Gass and Van Bartley. I was along for the ride. Van had all the talent, but I wrote that song and sang it. It was a divorce song. I found that I went through a divorce period, and music suddenly became very important to me. And I suddenly started writing these songs. I was very enamored with Elvis Costello, too, you know, angry, ripped-off love songs. So, you know, I Hope You're Happy as Me. There's a slight bit of irony there to the title. But it was very cathartic for me. And I found that, you know, it served very well to help me get through a period of time. I wrote a, you know, slew of songs in that period of time. And haven't done much of that since. It's funny. It seems like there was a real reason to, and then that reason disappeared. I'm very happily married and a father, and I can't write songs about that. It's hard. Golly. Hey, so.
This is David Brent Johnson. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is Indiana University professor of music, Glenn Gass. We've been listening to some music that influenced him and music that he actually helped write in talking about his interest in classical composition. Glenn, I know that we've talked a little bit about these demarcations between music and such, but I'm kind of intrigued by rock and roll's roots. We always hear about rock and roll's roots in the blues, but can it actually be traced all the way back to like early classical music?
I think you can trace it back as far as you want to go. I mean, it just you get to a point of diminishing returns where the connections get a little tenuous. I think the main point is that rock and roll is a uniquely American music. And so I think if you start with the sort of whole gamut of American pop and folk music, you can trace it to almost every one of those. I mean, they always say this about jazz. You know, the Ken Burns thing was like, jazz, where in America but jazz, you know, where else but America? It's right. It's absolutely true. Jazz is a uniquely American gift to the world, but so is rock and roll. You know, you can trace it directly to the blues for sure, and rhythm and blues, but boogie woogie and jazz and big band and country and western and bluegrass and western swing and certainly gospel music and certainly mainstream pop music. And, you know, there are just so many things that fed into the creation of rock and roll. That's what I find so exciting about it.
And now you're teaching it at Indiana University. At what point did rock and roll start becoming a historical music or something that we could think about as something that would be entering the canon, so to speak?
That's a good question. Personally, for me, after I graduated from college, I taught in Wisconsin for a year. I taught at a junior college in Baraboo and at a federal penitentiary at night. And I was hired to teach jazz and rock history. Which was really strange at that time. This is 1977, and I hadn't really heard of jazz history. Seemed strange enough, much less rock and roll in a college classroom. So that's what started my interest in doing it, and sort of thinking of it as something that could actually work in a classroom and make sense. And I'll never forget, I was teaching at the junior college, and I was talking about the Beatles, and one of the students raised her hand and said, "Could you slow down, and first, could you tell us what the Beatles' names were?" And I just thought, oh, my God, what's happened? Now, that was like 1978. It was the disco era. It was the Paul was in a band before Wings
right.
era.
Exactly.
And there was this sort of amnesia setting in, the sense that, you know, rock and roll had its era. Each band has its era, and then you move on. I never listened to big band music when I was in college, and there was a sense of, you know, the Beatles were of an era that was now over, and punk rock and disco, and the landscape had changed so completely. And then I contrast that with teaching the same course that evening at the federal penitentiary, where there was an older crowd, more experienced, and they had very strong feelings about the music, you know, as music, but also as something really, as you can imagine, incredibly important in their lives. I mean, that hour and a half when we were in class, I used to have students, inmates, you know, tell me that they felt free for that time, listening to music. They could be in their living room. They could be anywhere. And that was really powerful for me to think that, okay, and this is Buddy Holly we're listening to. This isn't Beethoven's late string quartet. So it opened my eyes on a lot of levels to, you know, the fact that this music had real lasting value and real interest.
You know, it seems that there was a phenomenon in the early 70s. It's the first time where I've really seemed to encounter it when I read back about it, where earlier rock and roll began to be revived. You had a nostalgia trend in the early 1970s with American Graffiti. Chuck Berry had a comeback hit, I think, in 1972. And suddenly...
My Ding-a-Ling is not something we want to talk about. But yes, there was a rock revival. It really started in about 68. Elvis did his comeback special. And the Richard Nader rock revival shows in Madison Square Garden started, and Bo Diddley and Little Richard, these people were suddenly, you know, if you're 22 in 68, you know, you were 10 in 56. So it's really that first rock generation going, hey, I remember rock. I remember dancing. I remember, you know, what it was like before it had to be Sgt. Pepper and Great Art. And it was with this sort of, you know, liberated sense of, oh, let's have some fun again. And I think that was, you know, very valuable. It was the first time rock sort of looked back at its own history rather than trying to incorporate Indian music or classical music or folk music or country.
Exactly. That's what kind of intrigues me about it. You know, the music just seemed to be moving so fast in those years. I mean, you have the phenomenon in 1967 with the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, of Paul McCartney almost mockingly singing, you know, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 in the background. I mean, only 3 years separate those two songs, and yet there seems to be an implication that they're worlds apart.
Well, yeah, that whole collage at the end with Greensleeves and Bach and Glenn Miller, and you love songs from all the eras, and including She Loves You, which did seem ancient by then. And, of course, the 60s were – you lived dog years in those years. You know, every year seemed like about seven. It was, you know, 63, 64. You know, by 67, that was ancient. You know, think of it for the little screaming teeny boppers to the hippies and the war protests and – so the times were very, very, very compressed, and I think there was this sort of emotional fatigue of things happening so quickly and having such weight to them that there was a sense of, you know, let's also have some fun. I remember in high school having 50s dances, which meant you dressed like Sha-na-na and you slicked your hair back and you went to the hop. It was sort of a caricature, but it was fun, and it was the first sense that this could live beyond its time, that this music could still matter. It would have been easy had the Beatles not come along to think that rock and roll would have been like the big bands. It was like the music of one generation of young people that was great, and then it faded with that generation. You know, by the time you had Fabian and Frankie Avalon on American Bandstand and Elvis in the Army or Buddy Holly dead or Jerry Lewis blacklisted or Chuck Berry in jail or Little Richard at Bible College, I mean, it was over. It was over by the early 60s, and, you know, that really did seem to be it. And then all of a sudden, along come the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and it's alive again.
Yeah, it's interesting. People think of this age as being a so much faster moving age, but these days it's routine for a group to take 3 years between albums, whereas the Beatles recorded, I don't know, probably what, 8 to 10 albums in that gap.
Well,
that we're talking about
the Beatles' entire recording career is literally encapsulated in 7 years. September '62, they made Love Me Do, and August of '69, they finished the Abbey Road album. So 7 years. I always tell my students, imagine your favorite band just broke up and they formed in 1997 and they did everything the Beatles did since 97. It's breathtaking, really. You can't even imagine it.
You mentioned Bob Dylan just a few moments ago, and I'd wanted to ask you about there was an article in the media not long ago about Bob Dylan's possibly being nominated for a Nobel Prize in Literature. What do you think about that?
Oh, well, there shouldn't be any question about it. Yeah, Bob Dylan has had such an enormous impact. I don't think it matters whether he gets it or not. It probably doesn't matter much to him. Maybe it matters a lot. He's so hard to figure. But I think in terms of whether it cheapens the Nobel Prize or something like that, I would really bristle at any notion of that. He is the Shakespeare of our time. He's such an astonishingly gifted songwriter who taught everybody else what songwriting could be. You know, it's impossible to imagine the Beatles progressing the way they did had they not heard him, or, you know, anyone else from that era. You know, it was Bob Dylan cut such a wide swath. You know, Jimi Hendrix, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, anybody, John Lennon, Ray Davies, Pete Townsend, Mick Jagger, everybody has that moment when they heard Bob Dylan and went, oh my gosh, you can do this, you can say this. You know, the Beatles may have brought rock music into a new era, but Dylan brought the lyrics, you know, the sense of what rock could express to such a much greater depth and a real sort of literate sense to the lyrics that were no longer sort of about teenage tribal rights or sock hops. You know, it's the other shoe dropping, I think, the Beatles and then Dylan coming along, and that's what made the 60s so exciting.
Well, I think that his name being bandied about as a possible nominee for Nobel Prize in Literature is an indication of how far rock has come in terms of its aesthetic status. And I think another indication of that is the fact that you are currently ensconced at the IU School of Music teaching courses about rock and roll. When did you start doing that?
Well, I came here to start working on a master's degree in composition in the fall of 1978. And like I say, I'd spent the previous year in Wisconsin teaching jazz history and rock history. So I had a syllabus. I had a set of tapes. I had, in theory, a class that I could propose. And that was very important, so that it wasn't just some strange idea from nowhere. The first thing I taught here was actually at the Collins Living Learning Center. It was a Beatles class. And I taught it in 1982. I suggested it. I proposed it in 1981 after John Lennon died. I'll tell you what really happened is I went to a composition workshop after John died, and I had a black armband on. And somebody asked me, one of the students, composition students, asked me what the armband was for. And I said it was John Lennon. They had started laughing. They thought I was joking. And there was this sense of to be so upset about a pop star's death was sort of ridiculous. And this is a time when classical musicians were proud of the fact that they never listened to pop music. I mean, really proud. You'd talk to them and they'd say, oh, no, I'd never listen to Beatles. I don't listen to Rolling Stones. You know, they grew up in the 60s, but they were proud that they weren't a part of it, which seemed really incredible to me and incredibly elitist. So I felt like I had to do something, and a course on the Beatles seemed like the thing to do. And fortunately, the people at Collins approved it, and it was sort of having that experience gave me the courage, I suppose, to go to the School of Music and say, hey, you know, I just did this class there, and it worked. What would you say to a rock history class in the School of Music? And that was 1982, 83, and to my shock, it happened, and to my even greater shock, it's still happening 21 years later. But
did you encounter any resistance to it all, or did you get wind of anybody from kind of like the long-running classical music establishment being like, you know, what sort of heretic have we let into the temple or anything like
that?
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes. Without naming names, yes, there were several encounters. I had one person, a music history teacher, ask me how I could spend even 1 hour on musical garbage, much less a semester. And the thing was, he wasn't being insulting. It really, he didn't consider it, you know, attacking me.
It was true wonder.
It's like someone said, could you teach a course on the cockroaches you've killed in your house? I mean, how could you teach a course on rock and roll? It just seemed, you know, barbaric and trivial to him. And there were a lot of people that had that feeling, you know. That, I mean, again, in that day, jazz history, you know, thanks to David Baker, was entrenched here, but in most places it was still kind of strange. Rock history seemed, you know, like talking about bubblegum. And, you know, I got to say, on the other side of that, you know, people like Henry Upper and Charles Webb, the dean, associate dean, went to bat for it. And, you know, they went to bat for the class in the face of a lot of people saying, we can't offer stuff like that here. And I've always been very grateful for that. And, you know, when it gets down to the bottom level, I've always had great support from the School of Music. And I've always been enormously proud that I do this class at the IU School of Music. That means a lot to me.
What sort of atmosphere do you have in your classroom? I mean, do you have a lot of students that sign up for your class and like, oh, this is going to be a lark. We're going to, you know, party hardy and just listen to rock music and cool and be, hey, I mean, what's it like? How do you structure it? What are your goals when you set out to teach one of your courses on rock and roll?
It's changed a lot over the years. My students now know a lot more than my students did 20 years ago. I mean, a lot. You know, I used to ask what the first rock song was, and people would say Elvis, you know, maybe Rock Around the Clock. Now, nobody says that. They're always arguing about which Robert Johnson song is the most rock-like, or which, you know, earlier song mentions rock in the lyrics first. Or there's just a much, much greater awareness of rock's history. You know, when I started the classes here, for one thing, CDs hadn't come out, and we forget this now, but boy, if you wanted to find, you know, some doo-wop song, good luck. You go to a record convention and you sift through stacks of singles. I had the great fortune of having a good friend, Jim Sherman, who was a doo-wop fanatic, and he gave me a lot of things to use for class because I couldn't go to the store and buy them. You were lucky if you could buy a Fats Domino collection. Things were just out of print and gone. And so it was hard. Not to mention trying to find videos, you know. And so when CDs came along and suddenly there's a box set of everything ever recorded and you know, you can get really literally anything you want, that really changed the landscape, not just for me teaching, but for my students. You know, everything's in play now. My students' record collection, CD, MP3, you know, players, whatever it is, are just crammed with music of incredibly eclectic, you know, varieties and eras. And that's been a terrific change, huge change. But the bottom line is my goal is always to make my students fans of what we're talking about. And yes, there's always this shock after the first test of, whoa, you mean this is hard? You mean I actually have to study for this? And
you've had, I know that one of the things that's become well known about your class is that you've had a number of classroom visits from rock and roll and blues and soul celebrities, including John Mellencamp, Neil Young, James Brown, and Lou Reed. I know that some of these visits have been surprises for the class. What's the reaction when Lou Reed shows up and starts talking to them about the Velvet Underground?
Well, when Lou Reed came, he was out rehearsing with the John Mellencamp band for the, I think it was the first, maybe the second Farm Aid concert. And the Mellencamp band was going to be his backup band. And they had a legendary surprise show at the Bluebird one night. And the Mellencamp band came out, and then Mellencamp brought Lou Reed out, and the place just went crazy. It was a great night. And I asked Lou Reed in that little alley by the Bluebird if he'd be willing to come to a rock history class and talk. And he didn't believe there was such a thing. He thought I was kidding. And I gave him my phone number, and he said he might call. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. And sure enough, the next day, I got a call from Lou Reed, and he ended up coming to class. He was afraid that no one would know who he was. You know, he was really nervous about that. And he walked in, and the place went crazy, of course. Everybody stands and cheers, and he was visibly moved. And he had said he might come for 5 minutes, and he ended up staying the whole hour and a half. And it was a great experience.
And you brought along some was it an interview that you did with him around this
time?
Well,
actually, I think this is pretty hilarious. It's when he called me that morning. I got a tape of that, and it'd be fun to hear that, actually.
This is Lou Reed on the telephone with Professor Glenn Gass when he was here in Bloomington in 1987.
So what is this class like? I thought maybe I could stop in like for 10 or 15 minutes or something.
The history of rock class, from like 50s to early 70s.
What would you want me to do?
Anything you wanted. I mean, they'd want to ask all kinds of questions if you wanted, or if you'd rather talk about your stuff, that'd be great. If you'd rather talk about what influenced you, or...
Oh, I don't want to talk.
Or, okay. Whatever would, whatever you'd enjoy.
Well, they could ask me questions. Are they rude?
No. No, they're nice, Midwestern kids.
Mm-hmm. Where are you from?
I'm from Indiana.
Mm. So they're Midwestern?
Yeah. Almost all Hoosiers.
Almost all what?
Hoosiers.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they seem pretty healthy and straightforward here.
Yeah. That was great last night.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It sounded great.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's going to be wonderful tomorrow.
Yeah, it was great fun for me. I don't get to see places like that, more or less plan.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. It really sounded great. He sounded wonderful, and the band sounded wonderful.
He's got just a great band.
Yeah.
I mean, they are really a great band. No ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Yeah.
Okay, because there were some things I wanted to do today, but We got the whole day.
I'd appreciate it if I could smoke in there.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Man, I don't think I've ever done anything like this before. it's really strange.
Just go around and bend to the right up here and then...
That was Lou Reed on the telephone with Glenn Gass in 1987, evidently a bit nervous about this crowd of potentially rude Midwestern or Hoosier students he might be facing in your classroom.
Yeah, it was so funny because he was obviously really edgy about it. And like, what do you want me to do? Well, you could talk about this. I don't want to talk. What are you going to do? And then he starts into this, what are they, rude? What are they? And I tried to calm him by saying, they're almost all Hoosiers. And clearly that was some exotic strange, oh, really? What's that mean?
That didn't reassure him.
No, didn't reassure him at all. But what did reassure him is when I said he sounded good. And he goes, oh, really? Oh, good. And then he calmed down, talked about the Mellencamp band, how great they were. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. And it was an interesting little insight into, to me, he's Lou Reed. I mean, Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, cool as you get. But he was paranoid, about how it went and how the students would like him. And on the way over to the class, he told me it was, and this is a quote, he said, I think this is the strangest thing I've ever done. And I thought, now coming from Lou Reed, given his life in New York, that's quite a statement. It shows you how far removed he felt from sort of being in a class with college students in the Midwest.
Exactly. I mean, this is a man that was present at the, Andy Warhol's factory scene in the mid-1960s. But it sounds like you blew his mind even more.
If this is the strangest thing he's done, then really, on the wild side
here. You're the Andy Warhol of the Academy.
Yeah. I mean, it was just really a glimpse into his wall would go up. He'd be New York, Lou New Yorker, and then it would come down again and he'd be real sweet and then it would go up again. And the funniest thing is when he left, we went over in his rental car, and being a true New Yorker, he had no clue what his rental car looked like. So he's just trying the handles on all the cars in the parking lot by the Mac. in his leather jacket. I thought it'd be great if the IU police came along and saw this guy trying to break into these cars, but it all worked out. It was really fun. It was it's like having, you know, Brahms walk into your music approach class and start talking about how he made his music. It was a great experience.
This is David Brent Johnson. You've been listening to part one of a Profiles interview with Glenn Gass, composer and Indiana University School of Music professor. Tune in again next week for part two of Profiles with Glenn Gass. Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, David Brent Johnson, and this is part two of a Profiles interview with composer and Indiana University School of Music professor Glenn Gass. And we were just listening a little while ago to Glenn's telephone conversation with Lou Reed, and you brought along a couple other audio examples of your interactions with some of these luminaries that have shown up in your class.
Yeah, well, Neil Young was going to come to class, and his tour bus got in too late, so he... Instead, I met him out at Assembly Hall, and he taped a little message to class, which I think is fun. It means a lot to me since he meant so much to me.
This is Neil Young's address to Glenn Gass's History of Rock and Roll class.
Good afternoon, class.
This is Professor Neil Young. You know, I really wish I could have been here in the classroom with you, but just one of those things. I couldn't make it, so I hope my music will make it. See you later, class.
Can I ask you one question about this rockabilly revival?
Rockabilly is, you mean 50s music in general?
Yeah, in general, right.
I think it's setting the stage for the 60s music that's going to come back.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, I think psychedelic music will be back in about 6 months, pretty big. And that, it's just because of the techno-pop movement and everything, people really can't believe that it's taken over like it has, but it really has taken over. So in a search for to go all the way back and figure out why it happened or whatever, I think music is just going to go through the whole thing, through the 50s, 60s, 70s, right back up to today. No, I think we're just retracing through our roots. People do it all the time. It happens every 10 years or so. You know, I'm surprised that the big bands haven't come back, to tell you the truth, but that might happen. I think it's because of the computerized beatboxes and the synthesizers. It's really forced people to go all the way back this far to try to rediscover where it all started.
What I find interesting about that was 83. He nailed it. I mean, he was exactly right. He was doing his Shocking Pink's, you know, rockabilly tour. He said the 60s, I think the psychedelic music's going to come back, and it did, right on cue. And in fact, you know, the 80s were sort of one big anniversary of 20 years since, you know, Woodstocks, Hendrix, psychedelia, Beatles, whatever. So he really was exactly right about the 80s being a time of sort of rediscovering and reinventing rock's roots, so...
It was interesting to hear him talking about the 1950s and what spawned the cultural phenomenon of rock and roll in the 1950s. I know that's a pretty big question to try to answer, but what accounted for that explosion of music in the 1950s?
Well, I mean, I really think it's part of a much deeper trend in American pop music, which tends to be sort of sentimental ballads and novelty songs until something comes along from black music, really, and kicks it into gear. I mean, it happened with ragtime. It happened with blues. It happened with jazz. It happened with boogie-woogie and swing. I think rhythm and blues was just the next generation of white teenagers sort of falling for a music from black America that had real drive, real fire, real rhythm. You could dance to it. It sounded like real human beings were making it. And I think that's the real subtext of the entire century of pop music is, you know, African-American impulses coming in and creating something really, you know, dynamic in the pop charts and white listeners and white musicians responding to that and changing it, taking it somewhere else and, you know, the sort of constant evolution. So I think that, you know, in that sense, it's just another in a line of those great sort of crossover moments. But also you had the great post-war, you know, 50s, teenage rebellion just waiting to happen. You had it with Marlon Brando and James Dean and Catcher in the Rye. You had it in so many other sort of media. It was bound to happen in music. And I think just once it ignited, you know, it was really like a fuse going off. And then Elvis was the detonation. He didn't create it, but he came along and showed that just how big it could be, what a cultural force it could be. Now, I've always thought it was sad that Elvis was the king of rock and roll. You know, Benny Goodman was the king of swing, Paul Whiteman the king of jazz. You know, it's something about our culture, isn't it? That it takes a white entertainer to reach critical mass, to make something really a cultural movement. And that's a really sad indictment of our society. You know, in a just world, maybe Chuck Berry or Little Richard would be the king of rock and roll. But on the other hand, I think it's cause for great celebration that when we needed Elvis, we got him. We got just what we needed at just the right moment. And, you know, he represented a great victory for black music, really, in the mainstream. Little Richard, when he heard Pat Boone doing Tutti Frutti, was livid, said, I'm going to find that man, I'm going to kill him, you know. But when he heard Elvis do it on the Ed Sullivan Show, he thought, wow, that's great. You know, my music would never have gotten there otherwise. So I think that Elvis was such a watershed moment and a really important moment in our history. There's a clip. It's a pretty famous clip of the president of the Alabama White Citizens Council, which is astonishing that such a thing existed. And he's standing in front of a placard saying, "We serve white customers only." And he's making a public service announcement to all the restaurant owners to take the Elvis records out of their jukeboxes. You know, and you know, in his dim-witted way, what he gets is that the success of Elvis is a victory for black music in the mainstream, where it might not have gotten otherwise. And it's more threatening to him, really, than some kid listening to some Little Richard record. So it was a really convoluted, really interesting time. I think that rock and roll did more to bring the races together than any Supreme Court ruling ever could. You know, that's for sure. And I think that's the story of our culture. It's the central issue.
Is there a particular year from the 1950s that you can kind of seize upon as a flashpoint year for rock and roll?
Well, 1954 is the one I usually seize on, because that's when the crossover records by rhythm and blues groups start really reaching a big pop audience. And then that's also when the white record labels start trying to cover it with Shaboom and you know, kind of whitewashed, sanitized versions of these songs, hoping they can cash in on this rhythm and blues fad until it just goes away. But it's also the year that Elvis records That's All Right Mama down in Memphis, down in Sun Records. And it's also the year of Brown versus the Board of Education. It's just a year when you know, so much is happening in our culture that is priming the pump for the explosion that comes. So, you know, but you can trace rock and roll back much further than that, obviously. You know, Rocket 88, song from 1951, is sort of the critics' consensus pick for first rock song. But you can go back to, you know, My Man Rocks Me With One Steady Roll in the early 20s, or all these old blues songs that are talking about rocking and rolling, and go certainly back to Robert Johnson. But 54 is the year I always look at as sort of the year when the fuse gets lit. And then it really blows up in 55. That's the year Rock Around the Clock went to number one. It's the year Chuck Berry had his first pop hit. The year Little Richard had his first hit. Fats Domino had his first pop hit. Bo Diddley comes along. I think that it's pretty significant that we're coming on to the 50th anniversary of that great year of 1955, because so much happened then.
You know, well, we're talking about the birth of rock and roll, but what intrigues me too is that rock and roll has been pronounced dead on several occasions, and one of the first times seems to be in the late 1950s, early 1960s. I guess a lot of people kind of jump upon Elvis's induction into the Army, but it's just intriguing to me that so quickly, within a couple of years, it was already – there were people, you know, ready to put it in the cultural grave at that point.
That's right. Elvis was in the Army and then in the movies, you know. And, you know, again, Jerry Lee Lewis was gone. Chuck Berry was gone. Little Richard was gone. Buddy Holly, of course, was gone. It just seemed like a wholesale massacre of the real movers and shakers from the 50s. And what you were left with was the industry doing what it always wants to do, which is sort of help shape, create, mold popular taste and market to it. And you've got the watered down sort of sexless Elvis, teen idols, Fabian, Frankie Avalon, with the perfect vehicle, American Bandstand, sort of promoting them, and the latest dance craze like The Twist. And you'd sort of return to novelty songs and sentimental ballads, really. It's sort of like the rhythm and blues had died out. And with it, you know, that impulse died out and rock and roll went with it. And you're left with sort of the early 60s pop landscape, which had some great things. Everybody knows Brill Building, girl groups, you know. But it did seem like rock and roll as a movement was over. And then when you least suspect it, there are the Beatles kicking it back into gear. And then the 70s, everybody said, oh, it's done. It's over, you know. And all of a sudden there's the Sex Pistols, you know. And every time someone says rock's over, Nirvana comes along or something else happens to kick it back to life. So,
We're talking with IU Professor of Music Glenn Gass, and we've been discussing rock and roll in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And Glenn, another group that was around, something that was going on in the early 1960s when rock seemed to be going through one of its periodic lulls, was the Beach Boys. And interestingly enough, their creative mastermind, Brian Wilson, has recently returned to an album that he abandoned, about 37 years ago? The album called Smile, which had kind of gone down in psychic flames in late 1966, early 1967. And then we have this really intriguing phenomenon of Brian Wilson returning to this what's been, you know, become a legendary kind of lost or abandoned masterpiece and finishing it up and releasing it. What do you think of it?
Well, you're right. For one thing, the Beach Boys were around in that lull, pre-Beatle lull, and they're one of the very few things, when you think about it, that survived the British invasion intact. You know, Motown did as well. But the Beach Boys took the Beatles as a challenge. They were on the same label in America, Capitol, and they rose to that challenge, and they were the great sort of American counterpart to the Beatles. So many people think of them as surf music and don't go beyond that, but I think that's changed in recent years. Pet Sounds has entered the pantheon as, you know, the second greatest album of all time after Sgt. Pepper, possibly the first. It was, you know, such a profoundly strong influence on the Beatles and on Sgt. Pepper. That's what I love about this era. You know, the Beatles put out Rubber Soul. Brian Wilson goes, oh, my God, I got to do something. And he makes Pet Sounds. The Beatles heard that and go, oh, my God, we're left behind. We got to do something. They make Sgt. Pepper. And it's in the midst of that period, 66, 67, that Brian Wilson was working on Smile, the great follow-up to Pet Sounds, which would feature Good Vibrations, you know, and Heroes and Villains, and then a bunch of other things that didn't really see the light of day in the original, you know, their original form. It was to be the album of all time.
It was supposed to be a response to Revolver, wasn't it? Kind of an answer to the Beatles' Revolver album?
Yes, it grew from about that time. A little started before then, but then certainly picked up speed with the inspiration of the Beatles. And, you know, he was working on a little, like Phil Spector used to call his songs, Little Symphonies for the Kids. And Brian Wilson inherited Phil Spector's sort of orchestral sense of what pop music could be. And no sense of embarrassment that it could be high art, that you could have orchestras and layer things and put them together the way a great composer might. And he got, basically got so involved in Smile that he lost his way. It became too big, too much. The drugs were becoming an issue. The friction within the band was an issue. Brian's own sort of emotional inner health was always very fragile, and that became an issue. And eventually it just sort of collapsed under its own weight and became the most famous unreleased album in pop history. And that's why it is sort of astonishing that Smile's been released. You know, you never thought you'd see that, and you never really thought Brian Wilson would get to the emotional point where he could revisit it and reassemble it and put it out finally. So it's sort of a real pop moment, and I'm really happy to see the attention it's getting, that this will place Smile on the radar for a lot of people the same way Pet Sounds emerged, you know, some years back.
Well, we're going to hear two selections now, and one is Wind Chimes as recorded by the Beach Boys for the Smile album in late 1966. And the other one is Brian Wilson revisiting the same tune just this past year for the new release of Smile.
That's right.
This is the Beach Boys, first leading off with Wind Chimes, as recorded in August of 1966.
Hanging down from my window, those are my wind chimes. On a warm breeze, the little bells like wind chimes. Though it's hard, I try not to look at my wind chimes. Now and then a tear rolls off my cheek. Close your eyes and lean back now. Listen to wind chimes.
We've just been listening to the Beach Boys First, we heard the Beach Boys in August of 1966 performing Wind Chimes for the Smile album, which then went unreleased at that time. And then we heard Brian Wilson doing the song just this year of 2004. What do you think about these two different versions, Glenn?
You know, I just feel like you're insulting Santa Claus to say anything about Brian Wilson. I mean, you know, he's one of the great geniuses of pop history. I do, as someone, see, these Smile takes, these Smile outtakes have been around for a long time, you know, and a lot of people have them and have heard them either legitimately released or bootlegs. And I think there's such a moody, deeply weird, sad atmosphere to the original tapes. And like Wind Chimes is a great example. It's heartbreaking. It's just this heartbreaking, frozen, strange moment captured on tape. And then when I hear the redone one, for one thing, Brian Wilson's voice is, he's older. But more than that, it just sounds like a group of musicians who are really good, who are sort of playing a classic. You know, it doesn't sound weird anymore. It doesn't have that sense of, you know, this music is deeply strange. There's almost something too reverential about it. So I hate to be such a Grinch, but I mean, I'm glad he did it, but I would rather he had gone back to the mountain of existing tapes and assembled the album from the original tapes, doing what he had to do to sort of make it, make the segues and make the transitions, because you can never play it or sing it. I love the Beach Boys' voices too, for one thing, but you can never do it the way, it's sort of like The Rite of Spring will never sound like it did in 1913, when it was so weird that everybody that was playing it thought, oh my God, this is strange. And there's this genuine sort of bizarre quality to the piece that gets lost as it becomes sort of a classic in the pantheon. So I think it's a really interesting moment of you know, was this a Beach Boys album, or is Brian Wilson essentially a composer and he's assembled another group of musicians to do his compositions? It's a very different way of looking at the music.
Well, we were talking earlier about the competitive rivalry between the Beach Boys and the Beatles in this period. And there's a story in Ian MacDonald's Revolution in the Head, which is a book, a kind of song-by-song assessment of the Beatles, where he describes Paul McCartney showing up during the Smile sessions. Sgt. Pepper wasn't yet released, but they had recorded it, and playing She's Leaving Home for Brian Wilson, and then kind of saying in a jesting manner, you'd better hurry up and finish. And MacDonald goes on to write that Wilson lost the thread shortly thereafter or whatever, and you know, didn't really return for quite a long time musically. But what you were saying earlier about what a fecund era this was, for that there was this sense of competition and everything, was all of this really spawned by the Beatles? I mean, when they came in 64, did they just completely alter the musical landscape in terms of what people thought could be done with pop music and rock and roll music? Or
yes. I mean, they really did. I mean, and then they set the pace, is I think what they did. You know, they didn't do everything first. They were very influenced by the Byrds and obviously by Dylan and certainly by the Beach Boys and the soul acts. But they had a knack, or, you know, the Jefferson Airplane or whoever. You know, there are similar stories of Paul coming to the Bay Area playing the acetates for Sgt. Pepper for the Jefferson Airplane and them going, oh, my God, you know. But there is the sense of everything happening, you know, so quickly, everybody responding to what happened last week and what, you know, somebody put out last month, and then sort of upping the stakes. But what they had a knack for doing is taking the newest ideas and the strangest ideas often and doing them with such authority that it became, okay, this is now the new plateau. This is the platform you start from here. I mean, Sgt. Pepper from any other band might have been some weird fringe album, some cult album, but it was the Beatles. So everybody had to listen to this extraordinary album in the way you might listen to Brahms Fourth or something and deal with rock suddenly not as dance music but as possibly high art. And, you know, with the whole production values and the way you make a record, the way you conceive of an album is more than just a collection of random songs recorded in one period. I mean, they just sort of upped the stakes with everything they did, and then everybody responded to that. Or, you know, poor Brian Wilson felt the rug had just been pulled out from under his feet. The album of all time he was working on had just been released by the Beatles. But they set a blistering creative pace. And the extraordinary thing is how many people kept up with it.
Well, you know, such a mythology has grown up around them in the several decades since they broke up. You just made an interesting point saying that, no, they didn't do everything new or innovative in that era. Although it seems to me sometimes as if they are often credited for, you know, being responsible for almost all of that era's innovations. But what, in your opinion, remains to be said or explored about their career? In what ways do you think their art and their cultural impact remains to some degree unmeasured?
Well, I think it's been measured to death, really. But I think what hasn't been measured is time passing and how these songs are going to resonate. I never would have guessed in 2004 my Beatles class, for example, would be bigger than it's ever been. It's 360 students. And they love the Beatles. And they're really interested in the Beatles. And they were born after John Lennon died. You know, it's sort of like Beethoven now. You didn't have to live in 1803 and see Beethoven walking the streets or be there at the premiere of the Eroica to love Beethoven. It must have helped. It must have been great to be there, but you didn't have to be. And that's the extraordinary thing about the Beatles is they summed up their time so completely, but now their music is absolutely timeless. And my students certainly don't listen to them as museum pieces. They listen to them as great songs that resonate in their lives right now. So I never thought we were this right, you know, about the Beatles, but it turns out we were. They were really, really good. And their music is, 40 years later, and I'm sure, hundreds of years later, will hold up really well because of the creative integrity and adventurousness of it.
It's commonly given as a reason for their explosive reaction that they provoked over here in 1964, the recent death of John F. Kennedy. But what are some other reasons that you think laid the groundwork for Beatlemania?
Well, certainly the Kennedy death, it's almost a cliche now, but it's true. The country was in such a deep funk. That Christmas of 63 was horrible. I remember it. It felt wrong to be happy, singing Christmas carols, doing anything. Just didn't seem right. And then along came the Beatles after just enough time that you were ready to let loose again. The kids could scream again. The reporters had something fun to write about again. And it just seemed like suddenly the 60s were in motion once again. And it was incredible to me that the two shaping moments of the decade happened so closely together, November 63, February 64. But also the fact that, rock and roll was really down for the count. Essentially, it was over. And for the Beatles to come along and breathe new life into it, I think that they came along at a time when things were at such a standstill in America, and they took all these great American musics and brought them back, and we acted like we'd never heard it before. I thought Roll Over Beethoven was a Beatles song. There's a whole second generation, not the Elvis kids, but their younger brothers and sisters who were ready for their moment, and the Beatles on Ed Sullivan provided that. When you looked, and suddenly the model was no longer Elvis shaking his hips in his oversized suits looking so cool. It's four guys with long hair and a band holding guitars making music. And everybody was shaped by that. Think of Roger McGuinn and David Crosby seeing A Hard Day's Night going, ooh, we got to start a band. Or Dylan hearing Beatles going, ooh, I got to go electric. I mean, everybody. And these are people that grew up on rock and roll. They didn't leave it. Rock and roll left them and became Fabian and the Singing Nun. Singing Nun had the number one hit at the end of 1963. Dominique, number one hit on the pop charts. So, we were ready for something. And boy, we got it.
What's your favorite Beatles album of all the ones they released?
That's hard, but Revolver, when pressed. And Revolver came out in 1966, and that's such a great year. Pet Sounds, Beach Boys came out. Aftermath, Rolling Stones, Blonde on Blonde, and on and on. It's such a great, the Birds are doing 8 Miles High. It's just such an incredible period. And I think it's also the last of the sort of pre-Pepper Innocence. Like, there's still a touring band out there, and just sort of giddily seeing what they can do in the studio. Ooh, what can you do with this? What can you do with that? What kind of sounds can we use? What kind of effects can we use? Instruments can we use? Then by the time you get to Pepper, they've announced that they're quitting touring, and it's all very sort of self-conscious in a way. But that's why I love Revolver. It's just there's a gleeful, again, adventurousness to it that I think is amazing. It's like a kaleidoscope.
Yeah, 1966 is an interesting year. A lot of bands stopped touring at the end of that year. The Stones, Dylan has his motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. The Beatles stopped touring. Everybody kind of disappears into the studio for the next couple of years. Well, this is going to narrow it down even more, but I was wondering if you'd tell us what your favorite or one of your favorite Beatles songs is and why, and kind of explain to us a little bit the nuances of what's going on in the song.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I will take you back further than to She Loves You, which I think is a perfect song. It's just the classic early Beatles song, obviously, with the yeah, 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 or, riff. But there's just such a joy to the song. And it's such a beautiful fusion of strong rock and roll with a beautiful, hummable pop melody. It really seemed to me to capture everything that was so essential about the early Beatles.
Glenn, can you talk a little bit about some of the things that we should listen for in this particular song, The Beatles, She Loves You, why it is one of your favorite Beatles songs?
Well, it starts off with the biggest drums you've heard since, you know, Buddy Holly died or something. Just this huge drum beat. And then three guys shouting, singing, "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah," with the greatest hook of all time. In full voiced, you know, just unembarrassed. "She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah." And then in the last "yeah," they break into a three-part harmony, a big, beautiful sung three-part harmony. And at exactly that moment, Ringo's cymbals come in for the first time. So it's like the whole song suddenly opens up. The high end is suddenly there. And as soon as the word fades, George is there with what I think of as sort of a lasso, that no, that little guitar tag that takes all that energy build up from just that big, beautiful opening and sends you over to the verse, and you start the first verse. And then, you know, the verse melodies, "You think you lost your love, well, I saw her yesterday," which is a nice little tip of the hat to Buddy Holly, that and it's a very Buddy Holly-esque melody. You know, again, it's a real strong rock and roll foundation, but a real beautiful pop song, beautiful pop melody. "It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say, she says she loves you," and you complete that beautiful octave, that gorgeous surge up. So it's a gorgeous melody, and then beneath that, John is holding down. He starts each line with Paul. He goes, "You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday." And then they're together again. "It's you she's thinking of, and she told me what to say." Then he joins Paul again. "She says she loves you," for that big push up to the ceiling of the octave. And then, you know, that can't be bad. And you get the harmonies again. And right when the words stop, there's good old George going blah, 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 with a little yeah, yeah riff on the guitar. "She loves you, you know you should be glad." And as soon as you get to that glad, you either have the little lasso again, blah, 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 saying we're ready for the next verse, or you get, of course, the great woo, the little Richard Harmony ooze that send you plunging into the chorus. It's like either, you know, it's one thing or the other, and it sends you in completely different directions. And it's just such a beautiful whole seamless package, I just think. Everything that's happening, the attention to details and just the sheer buoyant energy of the song is overwhelming.
Well, it's a wonderful description. I think the only thing that could possibly top it would be to actually hear it. Here is the Beatles' "She Loves You," recorded in 1963 and released in England in 63 and in the United States in 1964.
She loves you, yeah.
The Beatles and "She Loves You," and Glenn, the wonderful description you just offered of everything that was going on in that song, it's amazing to me to contemplate how, you know, they couldn't really sit down and sort of just self-consciously plan all those little things that you mentioned. It's a mystery to me, I guess, the sort of musical genius that's at work there, and not just in one person's brain, but in several persons, you know, brains, that all four of them, really. I mean, even Ringo, you're pointing out things that Ringo, who is routinely sort of, you know, probably unfairly kind of written off as sort of like the kind of the clownish, humorous guy of the four. But just all of these amazing things that are kind of going on at once, very little things. And that, how did they all kind of mesh and turn into this just amazing piece of music?
Yeah, it was, you know, team efforts in art don't work that well very often. And this was a unique one with John Lennon and Paul McCartney writing these songs, you know, complement each other so beautifully. And then the band working out the arrangements. You know, the Beatles never work as sheet music. You know, it just the words and the music are not the songs. The songs are the way George echoes the yeah, yeah riff, the way Ringo sort of shapes the song with the cymbals or coming off the cymbals for the chorus and then back on, the stops and starts, the literally the dynamics of the arrangement are the song. The record is the song. You can't separate the two. Or the way that it ends with that beautiful yeah ringing, making anything that comes on the radio sound kind of stupid, you know, right after it in 1964. It was a great team effort. And then you add George Martin, of course. I mean, how lucky can you get? They get the perfect producer to help take these ideas and serve as a conduit for them. In fact, you know, as time goes on and his role gets more important, you know, a song like like Yesterday, where they use a string quartet. And, of course, the Beatles never learned to read or write music. There was no need. They didn't need to. They would talk about chords or, you know, whatever language they needed to get their ideas across. But when it comes time to have a string quartet come in, you can't just tell them the jam or they freak out. So, you know, George Martin would work out with Paul McCartney the arrangement and then score it, literally write it out for the string quartet to play. And that was a real watershed moment as well, because once you've done that, you figure, okay, now we can do anything. You know, we can bring in any instruments. We don't have to be playing them all. We can really be more like composers, sort of shaping the sound and bringing in colors. And that's the way they started to work, really taking advantage of the studio as a creative tool.
Have you ever met any of the Beatles? Are they aware of what your classes and what you're doing with their music?
No, I almost met Paul McCartney. I was supposed to meet Paul McCartney, but didn't. It was heartbreaking. Probably wasn't fated to. No, I've never met a Beatle. In a weird sort of way, that's probably okay.
Have you met any of the
Beatles? I met Beethoven, and it was a real letdown. I just don't want to go through that again.
Have you spent some time over in England, isn't that correct? In fact, you actually teach a class over in through IU's Office of Overseas Studies sometimes in the summer on the Beatles.
Yes, that's right. About every other summer is what it seems to be. We go over, it's for IU students, and it's an overseas studies course. It's a three and a half week intensive session. And we meet for a couple weeks in London and a week in Liverpool. And it's Beatle immersion therapy. It's pretty terrific. You know, we go to every Beatle site that's still standing and many that aren't still standing. Especially in Liverpool, there's such a sense of place you get there. You know, when you walk down the streets where Ringo lived, and you get a sense of how far away London seemed, much less America. You know, it really brings them back down to a human scale. And, you know, you can't stand it in the middle of the roundabout at Penny Lane, you know, the shelter in the middle of the roundabout, and not hear that song differently from then on. There really is a banker and a barbershop and a firehouse. And, you know, you go to Strawberry Field, the gate of Strawberry Field, and that song takes on a whole new resonance after that. So it's a really almost mystic experience for a Beatle fan, I'd say.
Well, and they continue to there continues to be a lot of media attention paid to their music. It's still coming out in different forms. We had the anthologies that were released in the mid-1990s, the three double CDs that were mostly alternate takes, different versions of – and some songs that had not been released before. And then recently we had the Let It Be Naked, I guess is what they're calling it, release. What do you think about these subsequent revisitations of the Beatles catalog?
Well, I'm all for the anthology things, as long as they're marketed honestly, which is essentially these are bootlegs, outtakes, live recordings. I don't think anybody should buy them before they buy every album, you know. But as, you know, sort of like they're doing with Dylan, the bootleg series, finally putting out things that collectors already have anyway, we might as well put them out legitimately in good copies of them. You know, I think as technology goes on, I think the Beatles are overdue actually for a remastering. I think we need a new set of audiophile CDs out. But yeah, I just, you know, it's terrific music, and I think it anything that can be out there ought to be out there. On the other hand, something like Let It Be Naked, it feels a little bit like Smile in a weird way. It's sort of like Paul doing something he always wanted to do, which is get Phil Spector's strings and choirs off his songs. And if anyone's got a right to do it, it's Paul. But there's a fine line there where you're sort of tinkering with history. And so I don't know. I'm a completist. I'd love to see everything out. You know, but I think the Beatles have always been very cautious of their legacy, and I think that's a good thing.
Our guest on Profiles is Indiana University professor of music, Glenn Gass, and we've been talking about the Beatles. And Glenn, a little bit earlier, we were talking about George Martin and his relationship, his musical working relationship with the Beatles. And one of the tracks in which we can hear some of the ways in which he impacted the Beatles is In My Life.
Yeah, well, In My Life is such a great – in fact, it was voted the greatest song of all time by some Songwriters Association poll. So it's right up there. It's a beautiful song anyway. I mean, you know, there are places I'll remember all my life. The some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. It's such a beautiful, wistful embrace and acknowledgement of the past. And then with the second verse, you know, becomes the sense of love as a renewal without losing the past. I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before. I know I'll often stop and think about them in my life. I love you more. I mean, it just doesn't get better than that. This song was on both of my son's birth tapes. I made tapes for the delivery room, and this was, like, essential. And, of course, when Julie, my wife and I got married, this was in our wedding, and I've made people cry at final exams with it. You know, I mean, there's just any sort of passage in your life this song works well for. I certainly hope to have it at my funeral.
It sounds sort of like what you were just talking about when you go take your classes over to England and you walk around and you get a sense of these places that John Lennon was writing about.
That's right.
Paul McCartney was writing about.
It's like John in 65 in London at the height of Beatle fame, sort of looking back. If you're a Beatle fan, you know about his mother dying and his best friend Stu Sutcliffe dying and the sort of loss that had etched his life. So there's a real poignance, an honest personal poignance to the song.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places have their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall.
That was the Beatles with In My Life, recorded in 1965. Glenn, George Martin, the producer, was playing the piano part on that track. Is that correct?
That's right. It sounds like a harpsichord. Well, it doesn't really sound like a harpsichord. It sounds like a toy piano. It sounds like it's the impression of a keyboard. That's what I love about this song beyond the poignance of the words and the melody is it's such a perfect touch. When you get to a solo in a song like this, you're not going to go, all right, George, rock on. It wouldn't work. So they wanted something that would really capture the mood and keep the mood, the sort of dignified mood of the song. And in fact, they had a solo originally that George Martin played on sort of an electric keyboard, and it didn't work so well. But we can hear a little bit of it and hear what it sounded like.
Okay, this is George Martin's original piano solo from In My Life.
I know I'll often stop and think about them. Love you more.
Sort of sounds like a circus. You know, I mean, he's got the outline of the melody, but the timbre's not right. It's just too much. All of a sudden, here's a keyboard instrument, and they decided that wasn't what they wanted. So they started thinking, okay, what can we do? And he came up with the idea of playing the track, as you hear here, as playing it at half speed. So that's actually what George Martin did. They slowed the track down to half speed while he played a regular piano solo, slowly, and then realizing that, you know, when the track was sped up to the normal speed, the piano would be twice as fast, take on a completely different timbre and color and character, which in fact it did. If we kind of start the record back over from the solo, you hear now that tape, literally that tape, just sped up to normal speed.
I love you more.
So that's that same tape, but sped up. So the piano suddenly sounds like, it sounds like a sped up piano, but what you hear is not, okay, there's suddenly a harpsichord or there's a toy piano or there's a piano even. It's just the impression of a keyboard, this sort of baroque-ish keyboard. And it's like inventing a color. It's like, okay, if we mix these colors together to come up with something new. And there's suddenly this swath of color that goes through. And it seems inevitable. Like, what else could it have been? It's so perfect for the song.
I love you more. In my life, I love you more.
little piano or the little guitar tag, the da 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 da, never felt incomplete. But at the end, when you hear it, da 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 da, it's like you've been waiting the whole song for that resolution. And can you imagine that song without the breakdown when the band stops and John goes to that aching, keening falsetto in my life? It's like, it's perfect. It's a perfect song. Everything about it. And the care that went into it is so striking. And the care that goes into it without getting in the way of the real, just direct emotion of it. It's monumental.
And in retrospect, that seems like a fairly simple thing now, that they could do things like just speeding up the tape or slowing down the tape, although at that time it was considered somewhat, you know, revolutionary or different. And George Martin, I know, is the... As they went on, they'd be doing more and more of these things.
The studio was a place where you got a good mic level and a decent sound, and you recorded a performance. And that's the way it was for the first few Beatle albums as well. So they almost invent the studio as a creative tool, a place where you can go and actually manipulate the sound and shape the sound. And this whole sense that the record is the real medium, the real product of the artistic endeavor is the record, and that if it's you know, things that would have been considered gimmicks a few years earlier, just, well, why not? We're not going to do these songs live. See, once they got past that, any sense they're going to go out in a baseball stadium and perform Tomorrow Never Knows or something, you know, then they're free to do anything they want with any instruments or any effects. And, you know, that really opens up an entirely new colorful sound world.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, the impact of technology on rock and roll in general. And I was wondering what your thoughts are in the age that we live in now, what sort of impact the internet has had on rock and roll.
I think we're just learning what that is. I think it's not just the internet. It's the whole sort of digital age. You know, every kid, every junior high kid has a better setup in his basement than the Beatles ever dreamed of having. I mean, my God, with countless tracks and digital quality and, you know.
Makes you wonder what they would have done if they'd had that.
But, you know, they always said that they were glad they didn't, that there was a self-imposed discipline to everything they did. They had two tracks and then eventually four tracks and finally eight by the time they broke up. But, you know, when you only have four tracks to record Sgt. Pepper on, you fill up those four tracks. Then you have to send them down to another tape recorder before you can record anything else. And once you've mixed those four tracks, you can never make the tambourine quieter or make the voice louder. So you're always sort of telescoping ahead, thinking about, you know, what you're going to add and what room you have to leave for it and what the levels should be along the way. And if you add this effect now, what's it going to do to what you end up with later? It, you know, it's a really rigorous process. And not only that, but they're inventing the sounds, you know, the sounds we take for granted, flanging or, you know, chorus effects, were things they were inventing. So there is this sort of sense of discovery to their music that I think is partly what makes it so special. They didn't have a bank of buttons to push and, you know, little boxes to step on to get a different guitar sound. They had to find ways to create it.
How do you use the internet and the technology that's available to you today in teaching the history of rock and roll to your students?
I don't use the internet that much. We use a website, of course, but I've used a lot of multimedia materials. In fact, all of my courses are now on a multimedia sort of platform. I take a FireWire hard drive to class every day, and there's always something on the big screen in the classroom, videos, facts, pictures, audio clips. It's been really what I've focused on for the last many years, 7, 8 years, is creating class materials because they're really fun, you know, and it's fun to have all these things available in class. You want to see the Beatles doing this song at Shea Stadium? Fine, bang, here it is.
Better than a dry, dusty tome with maybe a few black and white pictures.
Right, and better than a stack full of cassettes and videos to pull out. Say, wait a second, let me cue this up. You know, it's been – I can't actually overstate how important it's been to my teaching. It's really made these classes work much better, but especially in a large lecture hall. A class like the Beatle class now, I think, works in a big room because of all the materials, and that's been the result of a lot of help I've gotten from the folks at the Teaching and Learning Technology Center, and Catherine Probst, my project coordinator. So to me, it's an ideal situation here at IU that I've had the kind of technical support to make my classes, you know, everything I would hope they could be. I mean, I sort of imagined what I wanted, and they found a way to help me get there. Now, that's a great thing for a teacher. That's not something you can take for granted everywhere. I think it's one of our real strengths. There's a real focus on the classroom here at IU that's really healthy, and it's certainly been a great environment for me.
What do you do when you're not teaching? What goes on around the Gass household on the weekends?
I make my sons listen to Beatles a lot. There's not a big line between teaching and not teaching life for me. I mean, a lot of my work revolves around that, which is the joy of it. You know, the greatest joy of my life is my family, absolutely. My wife, Julie, and I have two wonderful boys, Matthew and Julian. Matthew was born on John Lennon's birthday, which I'm very happy about that. Julian was born on Liam Gallagher's birthday. It wasn't quite the same resonance, but...
How ironic.
Yeah, but he is named Julian, which is a little more than a coincidence that's John Lennon's first son's name. So they're inheriting the Beatles with great grace so far. They really like the Beatles, and I think they always will. I think our generations were sort of anomalies. That I used to think, well, every generation hates their parents and hates their parents' music. And actually... You know, I've got a lot of students now that say, my best friend's my dad, or, you know, things like that. Or because of your class, I can talk to my mom because she really likes Joni Mitchell, too, and I love her. Or my dad and I listen to Hendrix together. You know, it's weird in a way that the music that split the generations apart is really
strange.
Bringing them together. But now we've got the baby boomers' kids, and music is a real tie to their parents. And they're not at all embarrassed that they're listening to their dad's favorite music. It's okay. And I think I would have cringed at that thought 10 years ago, but now I think, sure, why not? This is great music, and it was a unique era. You know, there's no shame in saying, hey, music today might not be as good as it was in the 60s. Hell, it's not as good as it was in 1800 either. You don't get Beethoven, Louis Armstrong, Muddy Waters, Beatles, Hank Williams every day of the week. You know, every music creates its classics, and... I think rock has its you know, golden era, and that's great that it's living on and that young people like it.
Are there any recent or contemporary musical artists that you follow with interest that seem to you to be sort of promising or good, if not quite maybe on the level of the Beatles? But
yeah, and I'd say something like that, and I think, oh, my God, I sound like my dad, or I sound like, you know, the music history teachers I used to have that thought music ended at 1945 when I was a composer, thinking, what's going on? I don't mean to say that. Like, there's no point in making music once the Beatles have broken up. This great music went on all the time. It's just, you know, the confluence of events in the 60s were extraordinary. And I think there is this sort of naivete that helps, you know, when you're shaping music and it's fairly in its infancy. You know, I think that there's something really special about the 50s and the 60s. But I really like Nirvana a lot. I thought Kurt Cobain was amazing. I thought the Smashing Pumpkins. I love Oasis. I liked alternative rock. I felt connected 10 years ago. And then Britney and NSYNC and techno came along, and suddenly I felt all disconnected again. Sometimes I look at the pop charts and I just think, oh, my God, I am a dinosaur. Beck is great. Wilco is great. You know, the sort of things you would expect someone like me to like, I like. But, you know, everybody takes their era with them. John Lennon used to say it never got better than a whole lot of shaking going on. And the reporter would ask, what about the Beatles? He says, nah, not even close. And you think, well, come on. But to him, it never did get better than Jerry Lee Lewis. So I think you take your life with you, for sure. And you can't listen to music when you're 48 the way you listen when you're 20. It's impossible. So, but that's okay.
Well, Glenn, thanks so much for joining us on Profiles today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
This is David Brent Johnson. You've been listening to Indiana University professor of music Glenn Gass on WFIU's Profiles, and we're going to end with some of his music. This is from his duo for viola and cello, the Inner Turmoil Movement.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in October of 2004. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this and other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.